You are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Today's subject, central hypothyroidism. Here's Dr. Lewis Blevins.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting from the coast of California on this beautiful day. Beautiful, but rather blustery. I just got back from a walk by the sea, and the wind was about all I could stand. So I thought I would come in and talk to you about central hypothyroidism today. Now, before doing so, let me review the physiology of the hypothalamic pituitary thyroid axis with you. So the hypothalamus makes a hormone called thyrotropin-releasing hormone that leads to TSH production by the pituitary gland, and it's produced and secreted by what are called the thyrotroph cells of the anterior pituitary. That hormone from the hypothalamus gets to the pituitary, traveling through the portal vessels that are part of the composition of the pituitary stalk or infundibulum. Once TSH enters the circulation, it binds to its receptor on the thyroid cells and leads to a number of different things happening in the thyroid, including incorporation of iodine and synthesis of thyroglobulin, for example, and ultimately the cleavage and release of T4 and T3. T4 is a predominant hormone secreted by the thyroid gland. T3 is a minor component, but T3 is actually produced in the liver and the kidneys by the peripheral conversion of T4 secreted by the thyroid. And T3 really is a predominant hormone. The receptor in the nucleus of the cells is actually a T3 receptor. It binds to thyroid hormone that enters the cell and then affects DNA to change a number of things within the cell, depending on the type of cell, that basically send the message about what the brain and the pituitary want the thyroid gland to do to different tissues. The T3 is measured in the hypothalamus and the pituitary in a form of negative feedback to regulate the overall production of T4 and T3. And this negative feedback cycle is pretty much the way a thermostat would work. To keep the temperature the same in your house, the thyroid gland and the pituitary and the hypothalamus work the same way. One other thing to mention is that once T4 and T3 enter the circulation, they are bound to proteins. In fact, about 99.97% of thyroid hormone is bound to protein. That sort of acts as a reserve, if you will, and there's an equilibrium between the amount that's bound and the amount that's free to enter cells. The main protein that binds T3 is called transthyretin, whereas the main protein binding T4 is called thyroxine-binding globulin. Now, all of this is tightly regulated such that we each would have our own sort of narrow range, if you will, of thyroid hormones. The normal range is derived from a population. So, say a normal range of T4 might be 0.8 to 1.8, for example. But every one of us has our own set point, and if we were to do repeated measures of our thyroid levels, we would find them to be in a normally distributed in a very narrow range. So normal for me might be 1.5. For you, it might be 1.2. For somebody else, 0.9. So that's another thing that we have to keep in mind as physicians, that everybody is different, and a normal test result doesn't necessarily imply it's normal for you. If you have disease, if there's no disease, whatever your results are probably normal for you. But if you have disease, we really don't know what's normal for you unless we have had the ability to see test results prior to you achieving or obtaining that particular disease state. All right, with that 3 minute or so introduction to thyroid physiology, let's talk about central hypothyroidism. Central hypothyroidism is a term that we use to denote hypothyroidism that's due to either hypothalamic or pituitary failure. And it can be due to any disease process affecting the hypothalamic pituitary unit. And in this setting, the cause of the hypothyroidism is that there's not sufficient amounts of TSH or a normal regulation of TSH production to lead to normal thyroid hormone production by the thyroid gland. Studies have showed that it's probably the TSH is not biologically active in some patients, and in others the mass secreted over a 24-hour period isn't enough, or the diurnal variation of TSH secretion isn't sufficient to lead to normal thyroid function. Now, this may be due to dysregulation of TRH production by the hypothalamus, or simply there are not enough pituitary cells to produce enough TSH to drive thyroid function. Now, you may have heard the terms secondary and tertiary hypothyroidism, and basically they're lumped together under the moniker of central hypothyroidism. But the old term secondary hypothyroidism usually referred to pituitary dysfunction, whereas the term tertiary hypothyroidism referred to hypothalamic dysfunction. Clinically, there's really not a lot of difference between the two in today's day and age, the way we sort of address this and treat it. The most important thing to keep in mind is that central hypothyroidism is due to failure of appropriate TSH secretion, and then the T4 and T3 levels fall. And this is differentiated between primary hypothyroidism, where the thyroid gland is diseased, and in that setting, when T4 and T3 levels fall because of the thyroid problem, the TSH level rises because of the negative feedback effects in the pituitary, senses the thyroid hormone levels are low and wants to try to bring it up. Patients with central hypothyroidism, the TSH is the problem. So even though some of the remaining pituitary cells might sense the thyroid hormone levels are low, there's not enough of them to produce TSH to try to bring the thyroid hormone levels back up to normal. So that TSH is a primary differentiating factor between what we call central hypothyroidism and primary hypothyroidism due to thyroid hormone disease. Another principal differentiating factor is that given that all forms of hypothyroidism can be either partial or complete, even in the complete setting, patients with central hypothyroidism don't have thyroid hormone levels that are as low as what we see in patients who have primary hypothyroidism. And that's because the thyroid gland itself can produce and leak some thyroid hormone into the circulation, even when your pituitary is missing. So what we usually see in patients is that the T4 and T3 levels are either in the low part of the normal range or rarely, frankly, low. And this sort of relates to the symptoms and signs of hypothyroidism as well, in that they are far less severe than in patients who have primary hypothyroidism that's complete. Some of the symptoms that we see that might be attributed to central hypothyroidism are maybe some fatigue, weakness, some decreased energy, and increased need for sleep. But it's extremely rare to see frank myxedema or myxedema coma or hyponatremia. Or severe dryness of the skin and the hair that we can often see in patients with severe primary hypothyroidism due to either thyroid surgery or Hashimoto thyroiditis. So again, patients with central hypothyroidism may have symptoms and signs of hypothyroidism, but they're usually mild to moderate in the scheme of things with regards to thyroid hormone dysfunction. And furthermore, many of these symptoms and signs overlap with other hormone deficiency states, so it's often difficult to determine are these symptoms related to growth hormone deficiency, sex steroid deficiency, or even cortisol deficiency. So let's now talk about laboratory findings and the approach to diagnosis. One of the important things to remember is that low normal levels of any test result don't mean you have a disease, especially if you don't have an underlying disease process. So having a disease process affecting the hypothalamus or the pituitary increases the likelihood that low levels of thyroid hormones are relevant and critical and important. So, for example, I could have two patients with a T4 level of 0.8, close to the lower part of the normal range. One of them might have a craniopharyngioma or a pituitary tumor, and the other one may be totally without disease, and both have normal thyroid functions, and I'm more likely to think the one with the T4 of 0.8 with the underlying hypothalamic or pituitary disease might have central hypothyroidism than I would be in the one who does not have any known disease process affecting the hypothalamus, pituitary, or thyroid. That's simply the way medicine works. The pretest probability has to be there to increase the likelihood that a laboratory test result that's abnormal is clinically relevant. And the other thing is that if a patient who has a disease process has any symptoms and signs that might be attributed to that particular hormone deficiency state, that also increases the pretest probability that laboratory test abnormalities may be clinically relevant. So, for example, if a patient has a history of a pituitary tumor and surgery and has a low normal T4 and has some weakness and fatigue, I'm more likely to put that patient on thyroid hormone than if they had no symptoms whatsoever and their tumor were gone, and especially if other pituitary functions were abnormal. The more pituitary hormones that are abnormal, the more likely that a low hormone level with regards to thyroid is actually meaningful. So, for example, if a patient has growth hormone deficiency and hypogonadism and maybe even central adrenal insufficiency, I'm more likely to treat a low normal thyroid hormone level, and I'm less likely to treat it if the patient has otherwise normal pituitary function. And that's simply because the way that the reserve is built into the pituitary gland, that we seem to lose our pituitary hormones in an order of progression or succession, if you will, with growth hormone and gonadal function being lost before you lose thyroid hormone levels, and then cortisol levels being the last to fall as a result of the ACTH deficiency being more preserved. And when you think about it, this design of the pituitary makes sense. The more critical functions, namely ACTH regulation of cortisol and TSH regulation of thyroid, are indeed more preserved than our growth and development, which usually occurs in adolescence, and gonadal function, because reproduction costs a lot of energy. And when it comes time to survive, you really don't need to be reproducing. You need to be making cortisol and thyroid hormone. So I sort of like the way the pituitary is designed, but that's some insight into how we make the diagnosis. Again, alluded to this earlier, in the setting of central hypothyroidism, we usually will see low normal or slightly low T4 and T3 levels. TSH levels most of the time are in the normal range. Sometimes they're low, and sometimes they might even be slightly elevated. And the fact that the TSH is normal just gives you an idea of what it was that five-second biopsy in time that it took that tube to fill up. It doesn't tell you how much TSH was made per unit time or over a 24-hour period, for example. And again, we think that the mass over unit time is less than what it would be. And then also with that TSH assay doesn't tell you the biological activity of that TSH. And we know that in some patients with central hypothyroidism, their TSH is not biologically active. So again, in summary, T4, T3 TSH levels usually low or low normal for most of those. And in the proper clinical context of one or more other hormone deficiencies and definite disease of the pituitary and hypothalamic unit, we can then make the diagnosis and start treatment. Now, when it comes time for treatment, the first thing I want to say is that there are a lot of misconceptions you're going to find out there in the literature about the proper way to treat thyroid hormone, and everybody has their own opinion based on their experience and their reading. And I will tell you that over a quarter of a century of practice of medicine, I still firmly believe that 85 to 90% of patients can be treated with thyroxine alone, and that's T4. Synthetic thyroid hormone. If you were to look in the PDR, or I guess now on the internet, you would find that there are 12 different dose strengths of T4, which implies that the dose should be titrated to the proper amount for individual patients. We know that T4 is distributed through the lean body mass of a patient with a little bit of a correction for weight mass that I'll talk about a little later. So that the bigger you are, the more thyroxine you're going to require. And obviously the converse is true as well. We also know that the older you become, the slower your metabolic rate of thyroid hormones, so the lower your dose requirement. And the younger you are, especially in childhood, the higher your dose requirement. In addition to T4, there are also T3 preparations and combination T4 and T3 preparations, and then the animal thyroid preparations. And I'll talk a little bit more about these in a moment, but the first thing I wanted to focus on is T4 therapy. Now, some patients with central hypothyroidism and with primary, for that matter, have partial hypothyroidism versus complete. My approach is always to provide full replacement rather than partial replacement. And the reason being is that if your underlying disease process progresses after I've adjusted your thyroid hormone dose, it won't be long that I'll have to adjust it again. And I would rather not be chasing the level, so to speak, where I have to keep stair-stepping the dose up as your disease progresses. So there's no harm in giving a patient a full replacement dosage as long as you don't overtreat them. So my approach is to use a full replacement dose in patients. And again, 85 to 90% of the time, I use T4 and I calculate that dose according to a formula that I'll relate in just a moment and will tell you that my dose calculation is right 80% of the time up front. And the other 20% of the patients, sometimes I have to lower the dose and sometimes I have to increase the dose. But usually I can control most patients with T4 alone. Then their liver and their kidney takes the T4 and converts it and makes the proper amount of T3 for their body. I mentioned that the dose requirements are related basically to the lean body mass, or the volume of distribution is sort of proportional to lean body mass. And I can get fairly close using a formula that incorporates your ideal body weight with a fudge factor for whether you're overweight or underweight. And generally for women, you would use the ideal body weight calculation of 100 pounds for the first 5 feet in height and then 5 pounds for every inch over that. For men, it's 106 pounds for the first 5 feet in height and 6 pounds for every inch over that. And then if you take that weight, and for people who are overweight, add 20% of the difference between that weight and their actual weight, you come up with a weight in pounds. Multiply that weight in pounds by 0.8, and that would give you the approximate number of micrograms of thyroxin. That would work for about 80% of patients in calculating that dosage that they would require on a daily basis. So, for example, if you're a normal weight woman who's 5 feet 5 inches, your dose requirement would calculate out to roughly 0.1 milligram daily. After starting therapy, I usually wait 6 to 8 weeks, and this is true for following a change in a dose, 6 to 8 weeks to reassess thyroid hormone levels. Because the half-life of thyroxin and the binding of proteins, it really truly requires that long to see the biochemical, if you will, effectiveness of a particular dose that a patient's treated with. And sometimes it takes that long for a patient to feel better in response to treatment as well, because levels have to build up over time. So what I usually check is a T4 and a T3 level, and I adjust the dose based on T4 and T3 levels, aiming to get the T4 into the upper half of the normal range. I don't want either T4 or T3 to be elevated. If it's in the middle of the normal range and a patient feels fine, then great. But if it's in the middle or the lower part of the normal range and the patient still has lingering symptoms of hypothyroidism, I might increase the dosage of the medication. Again, it's critical to not have high levels, because that's only going to cause problems in the long run that we'll talk about in a moment. The most important thing, and the one thing that if you take nothing else home from this podcast, is that we do not follow TSH levels in treated central hypothyroid patients. Remember, TSH is the problem. You have hypothyroidism because TSH is not produced properly. It doesn't matter what the TSH level is. It's not relevant. You have to follow T4 and T3 levels. And I stress this point in every talk and every presentation on central hypothyroidism, because it never fails, probably twice a month. I have a patient that I've treated with thyroid hormone. I'm happy with their levels. They're happy with the levels. They feel great. They see a primary physician who checks the TSH, sees that it's low, starts backing off on the dose of the medication, rechecks, finds out that the TSH is still low, and before you know it, patients are in my office feeling horribly tired and fatigued and weak, on a quarter of the thyroid hormone dose that I had them on, and it's all because their primary physician backtracked on the dose because they measured TSH. So don't measure TSH. Don't let your doctors measure TSH. If they do, threaten not to pay for it. But it's an irrelevant test if you have pituitary dysfunction leading to thyroid dysfunction. So don't do it. Teach your doctors, teach your friends, whatever, help spread the word. Now, with all that said, sometimes I see patients who have T3 levels that are lower than I like for them to be, despite the fact that they're on thyroid hormone. And many of these patients are on beta blockers or maybe amiodarone, and maybe some have a genetic problem with the conversion of T4 to T3, and they'll have persistent symptoms of hypothyroidism. In that setting, I will add T3 therapy, usually 5 to 15 micrograms once or twice a day. And I'll follow T3 levels to get their T3 level up in that setting. And it's remarkable the number of patients who actually do better adding T3 level to their T4 therapy. Sometimes if you're going to do that, you have to drop the T4 dose a little bit to permit the T3. Otherwise, they'll still convert some of the T4 into T3 in the liver and the kidney and end up with high levels of T3, and that's not a safe situation for a number of different reasons. There are animal thyroid preparations that are available, and some refer to these as natural products. I think they're natural if maybe you're a pig or a cow, because basically they come from slaughterhouses. And certainly if you're kosher, you wouldn't want to use this type of hormone preparation. The problem with them is that it's a combination of T4 and T3, and as a physician and the patient, we can't regulate the T3 that you get. And many patients that are on these hormone preparations do well, while a significant number of others have elevated T3 states and have T3 toxicosis, if you will, and they come in a little hyperthyroid and they don't feel well, so they want to take more medication. But it's important to remember sometimes the symptoms of too much thyroid hormone are similar to the ones that are associated with too little thyroid hormone, such as poor sleep. The weakness and fatigue of hyperthyroidism are very similar to that of hypothyroidism as well. So the main problem I have with the animal products is the T3 excess is very common. And then when you try to lower the dosage, you end up ending up with hypothyroidism. So I think it's a lot easier to use the synthetic preparations, if you will, to manage your hypothyroidism, or at least to try them first before resorting to the animal products. I would say probably less than 5% of my patients are on animal product thyroid hormone, and many of them do well, but still I scratch my head at the fact that someone can have normal thyroid hormone levels and then show up at the next visit with high T3 levels. Now, I'd mentioned earlier that T3 elevations are a problem, and the main problems are is that as you get older, they can stiffen the ventricle of the heart, so you have impaired cardiac responses to exercise. And the other problem is you can have cardiac arrhythmias, and in women in particular, there's a higher rate of bone turnover, and you can see osteoporosis as a consequence of long-term elevated T3 levels. So my advice is to be careful if you're going to use T3 therapy in addition to T4 or take animal products. Be very careful and make sure that your T3 levels are not elevated. Another thing to mention, in addition to the fact that dose requirements usually decrease with age, is that certain medications can impair thyroid hormone absorption, and these include calcium, iron, and aluminum-containing medicines, so you would want to take your thyroid hormone separate from these medications. And also, certain medications can affect thyroid hormone binding proteins, and in the setting of having hypothyroidism, result in a dose change, and those include oral contraceptives and testosterone and growth hormone. Growth hormone does it through affecting TSH secretion, but the oral contraceptives and testosterone certainly change the binding proteins. And then furthermore, other physiological states can alter thyroid hormone, and these include pregnancy, which increased thyroid hormone dose requirements, nephrotic syndrome, which would also increase it, and then patients who have gastrointestinal disorders like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis may also have an increased dose requirement as well. The bottom line is, because of this, it's important to see your physician. And once you're on stable doses of thyroid hormone, you probably should have your levels checked at least every year, sometimes every 6 months when you're younger and your disease process is ramping up. But certainly every year long term should your thyroid functions be evaluated. Again, don't check the TSH, T4, and T3. Those are the key levels to check in central hypothyroidism. Obviously, this is one of my pet peeves because I keep mentioning it, but don't forget it. One other thing worthy of mention is that some patients who require thyroid hormone may not require it forever. For example, if you have a pituitary tumor or a disease process that causes central hypothyroidism and you see a great surgeon who can remove your tumor and decrease the mass effect and change the blood flow dynamics to the pituitary, you may be able to come off thyroid hormone after surgery. So keep that in mind if you found yourself having been treated with thyroid hormone or requiring it prior to having pituitary surgery, that in some cases you may not require that lifelong, And if other pituitary functions appear to be normal, your physician might want to work with you, or maybe you should even suggest it to try to wean your thyroid hormone to see if there is a continued demonstrated need for the medication. Well, we could go on for hours and hours on thyroid hormone replacement and thyroid dysfunction in patients with pituitary and hypothalamic disorders. I wanted to sort of arm you with some information so that you can help your physician take better care of you. And I hope this has been useful to you. Many thanks for listening, and thanks for all of your feedback and support of our efforts at Pituitary World News. And have a wonderful day.